Saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, including pouring a walkway, setting a post, or even installing stone veneer. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Hi, and well, welcome back for me, but you guys are finally seeing history in the making. I've been trying to get a show with Chris for over a year, I think, maybe 2 years now, but here we finally are. Thank you for the huge super chat and congrats on the new show. Congrats indeed. I am so excited. Chris is here from Moscow. Chris, how are you? We have a ton to cover today, but first and foremost, please, 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 tell our audience about you, and I'm just over the moon.
I'm so excited to be with you all. Of course, some of you who've been followers of the show for a while have seen me occasionally on and doing some reporting. Sarah and I were just in Iraq just last month. It feels like, you know, forever ago. But it was amazing to be together. And now we decided to do the show together to bring you the latest, to talk about what's pressing in the world, and to give you, of course, an opportunity to really grasp the enormity of what's happening on the global stage and the transformations that are underway. So it's, once again, it's a pleasure to be with you all. I'm a researcher, geopolitical analyst, you know, lawyer. I do a lot of things, and I'm happy again to be with you all here from Moscow. It's a little bit late here. It's earlier on the East Coast, West Coast, in the central time zone for those in the US and Canada. But of course, a pleasure to be with everybody from all over the world here on DD Geopolitics.
So stoked. But first and foremost, we'll give you a short update from the front from our friends at VON-DV across three sectors in the Dnipropetrovsk axis. This is the Vostok update. The 29th Army sector, Russia continues to move. They're fully liberated the western outskirts of Novoselovka and are moving into other villages. In the 36th sector, they're on the northern edge of Ternovoy. And on the 5th sector, they are advancing towards Novonikolaevka. But more importantly, and what everybody's talking about today, is the huge Russian assault, huge drone attack on Kiev and other cities last night. Let's take a look. Yeah, boy! So early Sunday, Russia launched the largest drone attack on the entire war, the entire SMO, targeting multiple Ukrainian cities, including a direct hit on Kiev's Cabinet of Ministers building, This is marking the first time a government structure in the Capitol has been visibly damaged since 2022. The PM, I can never say her name, Svridenko. Anyway, they're all upset. Here's some of the aftermath. A bridge was struck in Kremenchuk, obviously impacting logistics. But here's your aftermath, and the fire still going at the Cabinet of Ministers. Euromaidan PR is not happy. Ukraine PM's office this morning. And of course, Keith Kellogg has something to say about it. Chris, what do you think is the message here being sent? EU officials are calling the attack a mockery of diplomacy.
Listen, the special military operation is ongoing. Diplomatic efforts and overtures to the Ukrainian regime have failed. Of course, President Putin has offered President Zelensky, quote unquote president, because he's illegitimate now, but has offered him at least to come to Moscow, the hero city, for peace talks. Zelensky declined that and instead said that Putin should go to Kiev. I don't think that's going to happen. So, of course, that means that, the special military operation will continue until everything is achieved. Of course, we had a statement from Dmitry Peskov saying that the recent meetings in the European Union and in the various capitals in the West, speaking about a force, a military force that would be able to keep the peace in Ukraine comprised of NATO troops from various countries, is, of course, exactly why this special military operation was conducted in the first place. And that's a red line for the Russian Federation. So, of course, it's very important to understand that the security guarantees and the national security objectives of the Russian Federation ultimately want a neutral Ukraine with no foreign troops and no foreign military bases that can be used to threaten or possibly attack the Russian Federation, which has been done, by the way. They did enter into Russian Federation territory with the Kursk debacle, which was crushed. But of course, that's important to understand that right now the Russian Federation is continuing its operations until its objectives and the root causes are ultimately addressed and answered for.
I don't think that's going to happen. We do have some reactions from the Americans who still don't get it.
Russia has launched a very significant attack on Ukraine and in Kyiv. They actually even hit a Ukrainian government building. Does the U.S. condemn the assault? And what are you waiting for now in terms of triggering those sanctions on Russia?
Well, as you know, I'm not one of the foreign policy advisors of the president, but at the National Economic Council, we are responsible for making sure that sanctions get enforced and that people that are helping Russia with their war against Ukraine, as, for example, India has been doing, by buying Russian oil, that we're ready to respond to them economically. And, you know, the last night's news is very disappointing, and I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of talk today and tomorrow about, you know, the level of sanctions and the timing of sanctions.
The timing of additional sanctions,
perhaps, yes,
on Russia.
I mean, it's up to the president in the end, but yes, it's a very disappointing set of affairs.
Up to the president.
Are you ready to look to the second phase of sanctions against Russia or punishing Putin?
How was your call with the prime minister?
Moving into the second stage of sanctions against Russia, are you worried? You're in Moscow.
No, not worried at all. And the Russian Federation has already withstood enormous pressures and economic pressures with this coercive sanctions regime that has been placed not only since 2022, but also the architecture of which was from 2014 onwards. I think that right now the Russian Federation is prepared to continue its various methods and ways to combat these sanctions and to continue to provide for the Russian people and the Russian state. So whatever Trump wants to do, Trump now and the U.S. government want to impose sanctions, secondary sanctions on other countries who do business. But of course, for those who just recently watched what happened in Beijing, I don't think that there's going to be a big impact, especially after before that, the SCO meeting. I don't think we're going to see that. In fact, these countries are coming closer together as more and more coercive pressure is put on them, because ultimately this is exactly what many have been speaking about for decades, the coercive and hegemonic nature of the West.
Well, speaking of coming together,
no one told you that
I had to work that video into this episode somehow.
It was a great one.
Brought me so much joy. Anyway, we had the SEO and the parade in Beijing. I've talked about it so much this week, but I'm sure people want to hear Chris's thoughts. So for the SEO, Chris, we had the establishment of a new SEO security and coordination center, the launch of the new SEO bank, and the Tianjin Declaration and Development Strategy was adopted for 2035. What do you make of these huge outcomes, the development of a bank? And they've stressed a lot of security at the SEO.
Yes, absolutely. I think first and foremost, the new SCO security architecture comes on the heels of Israeli and U.S. aggression and an illegal war on Iran, this 12-day war that occurred two to three months ago. So ultimately, what many of the member states are speaking about is we need a new security architecture. And of course, what came out of the SCO was strong condemnation of Israel's aggression, as well as other aggressive moves by hegemonic powers. So you are seeing the SCO take a more firm position in terms of security architecture. Some even fear, there has been some talk that the SCO could be the new Warsaw Pact. That's what some people are talking about in foreign policy circles in Washington and in Brussels. So I think that ultimately stokes fear in their hearts that somehow this could be the beginning of a new access that they are, of course, deeply concerned about. Of course, they don't look in the mirror to know that they are the access. And these ones are the freedom fighters. But okay, you know, the SCO Development Bank is also a huge thing. It's important to note that just recently, Dilma Rousseff, who was the president of the BRICS Bank, and mm-hmm. I believe still is, was awarded the highest friendship order from China, which President Putin has and a few other world leaders. And so it shows the tremendous impact that these new banks of the global south and this rising multipolar world are having in terms of their enormous impact on investment, development loans, and overall economic inputs into these developing countries. And of course, ultimately, the strategy of the next 10 years, basically a 10-year plan, which some people were like, oh, we're back in Soviet times, we're going to go 5, 10, 15-year plans. But this 10-year plan that was adopted is really important. It shows more integration, more deals. Of course, it's important to note, this SCO meeting had over 20 major deals signed between member countries. And that was huge. We're talking about tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars in the long term, trillions of dollars in terms of much larger infrastructure projects that we've seen, including what we'll speak about, Power of Siberia 2. Many of these things are critical. And that was the big, big fear of many in the West, is that, and this is actually something that was addressed in the Western media, that this ongoing aggression by the US has pushed all of these countries further together and has cemented their ties, because their ties are based on mutual respect and win-win cooperation and diplomacy, whereas the West is based off of coercion. And that coercion has rubbed people the wrong way for too long at this point.
Actually, both leaders spoke a lot about that. We'll get to some clips of that. But you mentioned Power of Siberia. So that was another huge topic. This is, maybe some of our viewers don't know, this is Power of Siberia 2. Power of Siberia 1 is already in existence. Power of Siberia 2 will vastly expand this network. It's something that obviously is a threat to the West. So at the SCO Summit and Beijing Parade, Gazprom and China's CNPC signed a legally binding memorandum to construct the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline, which will run through Mongolia and will deliver 50 billion cubic meters of natural gas annually to China. This also increases volumes through already existing pipelines. For Russia, this pipeline will be a critical pivot to Asia, obviously, with the downing of Nord Stream and other pipelines under attack. This project will become the largest and most capital intensive in the global gas industry and will increase revenues for Russia up to $4.3 billion per year. This pipeline reinforces China's dominance with a more secure long-term pipe gas supplies and will combined with capacity expansion of existing pipeline, will bring the total to over 100 billion cubic meters annually, making Russia China's leading gas supplier. This is enormous.
Oh, this is huge news. I mean, we're talking about this is what many in Washington feared. And even Trump himself alluded to, and I'm sure we'll get to it, but this is exactly what the fear was, that over time, but of course it shouldn't be a fear because the Soviet Union helped to build the People's Republic of China. It was Soviet scientists and engineers who built their steel factories, their oil industry, their chemical plants, their infrastructure after the Chinese Civil War had ended and the Communist Party had been victorious. So there had already been a decade of integration and a decade of really strong ties. Of course, you had the Sino-Soviet split and all that, but China and Russia have always been in a sort of strategic partnership, given their geography, given their shared values, given their shared enemies, or those who consider them enemies and that brought them closer together. So it's only a matter of time before something like this was to come. And
you're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter Trusted Pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter Trusted Pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
We see greater cooperation, and that we've heard this spoken about in recent weeks, greater cooperation in the Arctic, greater cooperation with energy, not only in terms of natural gas and other petroleum products, but also in terms of nuclear energy. We're seeing a broad scope of work being done on a wide array of issues. And of course, let's understand who were the three big heads. It was President Putin, President Xi, and leader Kim Jong-un. The three of them together represent the three countries that border one another, by the way. They all share borders with each other. They represent the new major alliance in Eurasia that will be ultimately the major stop to Western hegemony. And I think that that's very important to understand. So this gas deal is part of a much larger overall strategic plan to really reshape the international order.
And we did get a reaction to that. Let's see.
Vlad lost his customers in Europe. Now America is selling energy to the French and Germans. So Putin's putting down a big old pipeline to China. It's supposed to be finished next decade and supply 15% of China's energy. Russia and China are growing closer. Someone might have to bomb that pipeline like Nord Stream. Trump's not thrilled with Pooty Poo.
Yeah, they're just saying it out loud. You know, when Cy Hirsch wrote that he had information that it was, you know, the West, it was the West that conducted the operation against Nord Stream 2, everybody was like conspiracy theorists. They called us Kremlin apologists. They said we were all wackos and conspiracy theorists. And now you have a major Fox News host saying live on air that somebody has to bomb that pipeline. I mean, the book's wide open for everyone to see at this point. They're not even hiding it.
No. Someone's going to have to bomb that pipeline. You're going to go into Russia or China or Mongolia and bomb a pipeline.
Exactly. Exactly.
They're working on the Druzhba pipeline right now. But I will, just for shits and gigs, we will show you another highlight.
We'll be right back.
Before we get to the wordy parts, what did you think of the parade?
Listen, as somebody who lived in China for 2 years, got my master's degree at a Chinese university on a China government scholarship, I'm very proud of the enormous strides China's made. And I lived there from 2013 to 2015. So over a decade ago, I was there. And you've just seen China constantly building and advancing. And really, this idea of constructing socialism has been at the forefront. And the modernization and the industrialization has been at the forefront. You see their tech sector, you see their AI, their robotics, their military. I mean, their military hardware alone has eclipsed the United States now. And it only goes to show that the Soviet model was correct, but needed some additions. And that's what the Chinese model has allowed. The Chinese model built on the Soviet model and was able to adapt it to new conditions and help to refine it into a major powerhouse at this point. And I think that that's something that we have to understand. I mean, for me, look at the discipline. I mean, for you and I are both former members of the U.S. military. So we can understand that looking at that parade, that is a military discipline. You know, the sort of the pride in the uniform, the parade, you know, the marching, everything. Just that you could tell that they felt a pride. You saw Trump's parade and you thought you were at a rock concert. You thought you were at a rock concert and everybody was high and drunk and just doing their own thing. But you see the very big difference. And of course, I had a lot of comments because I talked about this on X. I had a lot of comments from other former military personnel saying, well, we have more combat experience. Of course, my response was, we lost in Afghanistan. We got our ass handed to us by the resistance in Iraq. We don't seem to be able to do anything to harm any of these countries that we've been involved in. And so, of course, you know, as somebody who was in that military and left and resigned from that military against its policies, you know, from the onset, I think one thing that you understand is the U.S. military, for all of its sort of, you know, chutzpah about its military power and its technological superiority, has now been eclipsed. And let me tell you, by the way, because some people said in the comments, China and the U.S. have never gone head to head. They did. In the Korean War, they went head to head. And the Chinese pushed them back from nearly the border of China all the way to the 38th parallel, right? So I'm just saying, it's already been tried. It's already been tried, and the Chinese were able, with overwhelming heroism, with far cruder weaponry and logistics, were able to push the American troops all the way back. Actually, it was not the U.S. troops only alone. It was a UN. Right?
Yeah. So, and guys, read this book, please. I recommend it all the time. Patriots, Traitors, and Empires. It's the only decent book I can find in the West about the Korean War, if you want to know what we did to Korea, the forgotten war.
Exactly.
Exactly. So, and keeping in with that theme, I really want to get you to kind of discuss this video with our audience. I discussed it with Danny from, or Eddie from Midwest Marks. And I want to discuss it with you. Maybe not. Maybe it just doesn't work. Well, I was trying to play. Let's see if I can get it on my share screen. I doubt it, though, because Twitter never works for me. I haven't bookmarked. Okay. I think I have it here. Here we go. Thanks, Aria. Now I have to, like, I can never do, I'm such a boomer when it comes to this. All right, here we go.
历史承载过去. History carries the legacy of the past and inspires the future.
新时代,新征程.
On a new journey in a new era, the Chinese people of all ethnic groups should, under the strong leadership of the Communist Party of China, follow Marxism-Leninism,
Mao Zedong
thought,
Deng Xiaoping
theory,
三个代表重要思想,
the theory of three represents,
科学发展观,
and the scientific outlook and development.
贯彻,
and fully implement the thoughts on socialism with Chinese characteristics for the new era. We should stay firmly on the path of socialism with Chinese characteristics and carry forward the great spirit of the war of resistance. We should press ahead with enterprise and resolve and advance in unity the cause of building China into a great country on all fronts and realizing great national rejuvenation through China's modernization. The great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation is irresistible. The noble cause of peace and development of humanity will prevail.
So I wanted you to get to talk about what Mao Zedong, Deng Xiaoping, thought is to our audience and try to get your perspective on that, because we're going through... oh, I didn't play the video. I'm sorry. But as long as you heard the audio, it's fine.
Yeah, we got the audio.
Okay, sorry about that. Anyway, my bad. So anyway, yeah, discussing what Marxist-Leninism thought is, what Mao Zedong thought is, and what Deng Xiaoping theory is, Chinese or socialism with Chinese characteristics. We're going through a time in the United States where we're going through another like McCarthyism 2.0. So maybe if you could shed some light on what these sorts of ideologies are.
Sure, of course. I mean, Marxism-Leninism, of course, is the ideology, was the preeminent ideology in the communist world, the Third International. Of course, Marxism-Leninism as a term, as an ideological term, was, of course, brought forth by Comrade Stalin. And it was really the preeminent ideological outlook. It was really Leninism, but at a whole new stage of advancement and industrialization. Of course, after the de-Stalinization period, there was a real attack on Marxism-Leninism with the way in which Stalin understood it to be. And of course, the attack on Stalin ultimately meant a degradation of Marxism-Leninism. However, Mao, Chairman Mao, never agreed with the de-Stalinization and ultimately looked to Comrade Stalin as a preeminent Marxist-Leninist thinker and as someone in the proud tradition. That's why they have the five heads, right? Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, Mao. So especially during the period of the 50s, after Khrushchev's secret speech and after the period of de-Stalinization in the Soviet Union and in the Eastern Bloc, China actually ramped up its efforts to promote Comrade Stalin and effective leadership. And of course, this was also part of the drive towards the Great Leap Forward and then afterwards the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. Mao Zedong thought is, of course, applying Marxism-Leninism to China and its conditions. Of course, mainly speaking about peasantry, China was in a unique situation given its feudal characteristics, the warlord period. Of course, there were tremendous ideological and theoretical advances during the guerrilla war, especially during the anti-fascist and anti-imperialist struggle that occurred for a few decades. There were also tremendous advances theoretically into not only what the Chinese state should look like in theory and practice, but also the power of the masses. This is what, you know, some Maoists will call mass line. When you look, for example, at the bureaucracy, this was Mao's later critiques at the bureaucracy. Of course, we eventually have the giant calligraphy posters bombard the headquarters and then the rise of the Cultural Revolution. All of these things to say that Mao Zedong's thought, which of course is interpreted by the modern Chinese state as being 70% correct, 30% incorrect. That's what they say for Chairman Mao. This ultimately is rooted in the Marxist-Leninist interpretation of Mao with Chinese characteristics, given its conditions at the time. So they will look at Mao from especially the pre-PRC period up until the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, actually really up until the Great Leap Forward. And they'll say that was Mao's good time. And then it didn't get so good, you know, from the late 50s onwards to the 70s. But that's Mao Zedong thought, really. And it's really... a Chinese version of Marxism-Leninism. Ultimately, then you get Deng Xiaoping theory, which is very much about opening up reform of the system. This is why, for example, many online call some of us Dengists and things like that, that this was a betrayal of Mao. Although I think that there's a lot of debate as to what that looks like. And I don't think that it was an actual betrayal. I think it was also an advancement. And the truth is ultimately rooted in a key bargain and a key way in which the Chinese eventually put this to the masses. In the late 80s, when there started to become really, you could say, you could argue, and some have in the academic world, a second cultural revolution, but one much more Western in style. When you look at it and you say, okay, do you want economic liberalism or political liberalism? Of course, this was the great question posed to the Chinese people. And eventually the Chinese people and the Chinese state agreed that there can be reform in the market, but that the Chinese Communist Party must maintain its preeminent position in society because it is the only safeguard of the sovereignty and the will of the people in China. The Soviet Union, on the other hand, with Glasnost and Perestroika, eventually chose not only economic liberalism, but political liberalism, leading to the absolute liquidation of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Communist Party, the Soviet Union, the chaos of the 90s. And eventually it wouldn't be until President Putin comes back on the scene that you would have the preeminence of a sovereign figure in a country like the Russian Federation to maintain control and sovereignty of the people. And so
Tropical Smoothie Cafe welcomes you to Tropic Time. I'll be your concierge. Our beach bites, including made-to-order wraps and bowls, are full of tropic vibes. And our fresh-from-the-blender smoothies make you feel absolutely radiant. It's like a wellness retreat for your taste buds. You're on Tropic Time now at Tropical Smoothie Cafe. Got breakfast plans? At Tropical Smoothie Cafe, hitting your protein goals is a breeze. With our smoothies, bowls, wraps, and diets featuring up to 32 grams of protein.
This great bargain is really at the core of Deng Xiaoping's theory. Then, of course, you have, for example, the three represents. You have, of course, the new outlook on socialist development, which comes. So you have Jiang Zemin, and then you have Hu Jintao. Although Hu Jintao has slowly been sort of sidelined some of his thought to go directly to Xi Jinping, which sees, for example, the harmonious society, a lot more of this socialism with Chinese characteristics. You have, of course, the volumes of his works, which really focus on not only the strengthening of the party and the strengthening of the cadre, but also on reforms that allow for, that they can be seen by some ultras as technocratic, but they are very much about, okay, we are a new society. We need to have technological capabilities. This technology has to impact and be represented in the party. The party cannot only be bureaucrats. The party must be experts who understand the various aspects of economy, of technology, of social welfare. Poverty alleviation has been a great trend in later instantiations of this. So really, Jiang Zemin and after, the idea was that the class struggle in China has a new dimension. There's no longer the class antagonisms that existed before. Now China is experiencing the growth of a middle class. And of course, it has its billionaires. There's no doubt about that. But this antagonism can be handled within the party and within the state in a different way than the antagonisms of the feudal society and the post-Civil War experience in China, which had to root out a lot of these feudal forms. So there has been a transformation here, and this has been spoken about by some Chinese Marxist theorists. There are, of course, those who dissent, and they're considered to be the ultra-left in China. But the vast majority ultimately understand this transformation as being one needed to be achieved peacefully, not with the chaos that was from the 60s to the 70s. And that's very much at the core of the political project in China today. So when you hear that, it goes to show that China recognizes the totality of its history in the People's Republic and the totality of the ideological transformation as being built upon one another. And that's very important because Marxism is not a dogma, it's a science. And Chinese take that very seriously. And ultimately, you have to say, the Soviet Union is not around anymore. China's still here. And that's because the Chinese model has applied much of this scientific thinking to its ideological perspectives And of course, the theory informing practice, practice informing theory, has been at the core of this project ultimately.
And that's, I mean, I think that was really important that China's constantly, Russia does it as well. Some other, the other civilizational states do it, is the references to the history and the solidarity. I think that America is seriously lacking when it comes to that sort of, I don't want to call it backwards thinking, but America sort of kind of disregards the past in its entirety from a holistic standpoint. But we presented SCO as sort of an alternative to maybe NATO. But I think that it's becoming even bigger than that. At the SCO conference, they announced Xi's new global governance initiative. So this is China's fourth major global framework. So the first was the Global Development Initiative, which was the economic model. Global Security Initiative, obviously your security model. Global Civilization Initiative, which was your ideological and cultural. And now we have your Global Governance Initiative, which I think it sounds as important as it is. Thank you for the super chat. And so this one is the CGI, or the GGI, is China's attempt to redefine the rules of international order to shift away from the U.S.-led post-World War II framework toward a multipolar, non-Western model of global coordination. So I'll just go over the five pillars of this model. It's sovereign equality. Each country has the equal rights in international affairs. International rule of law. Global rules should be negotiated multilaterally, not unilaterally imposed. Three is true multilateralism. UN-centered systems should be respected and reformed. This was a subtle jab at the US-led coalitions like Quad and NATO. Four is people-centered governance. Focus on development, poverty reduction, and inclusive governance. And fifth and final is your action-oriented cooperation, which he said is not slogans, but solutions with mechanisms that deliver tangible results. It's being looked at as a direct challenge to the Bretton Woods system, liberal interventionism, and Western universal values. So we're finally getting, are we getting our new world order?
I think we are. I definitely think we are. And we're there at this point.
Why do you think it's accelerated so quickly in the last maybe 6 months? It feels like one of my friends, he actually is the one who sent the $50 super chat. Thank you again. He said, it feels like they're on a deadline. What's the, it feels like everyone's on a deadline, more so the Americans, but now it feels like this has accelerated as well.
I honestly think that there's a variety of issues at play. I think that from 2022 to today, we've seen an acceleration, but more importantly, we've seen an acceleration as many of these countries have deepened their relations. But also, let's not forget, in the past few months, we've seen the United States once again take action against a country it has not taken military action against before. And not only that, a major player in West Asia, a major country involved in relations with the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China in trade, in atomic energy, in so many domains, in gas and petroleum. And what you're really seeing is, look, the United States is still a belligerent power. It's still a power that only understands force. You know, it's very interesting. When Mr. X, quote unquote, wrote the paper on Soviet power that ended up driving Cold War doctrine, this was, of course, Kennan's favorite famous paper in foreign affairs. He said that the Soviet Union only understood power, direct power, overwhelming power, right? That it only understood power by force. It was projection. It's the United States that only understands power by force. They projected that on the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union acted very rationally. In fact, of course, they gave up Greece during the period after World War II. And there goes, you know, how I ended up in the West. But, you know, I just think about, like, Stalin was a very rational actor in terms of international affairs and could have gone for world revolution, which is what the Trotskyists were talking about, but instead chose to be very calculated, especially in an emerging nuclear world. The United States did not go that way. The United States immediately embarked on a massive 60-year project to reshape the international world order. And so with that, what you ended up having was a situation where many countries eventually looked and said, okay, well, we're not the problem. They're the problem, right? And so even though a lot of their elites had been trained to say that they were the problem, especially this is the Yeltsin era where, oh, we Russians are, you know, secretly bad and we need to, you know, bring and adopt all Western forms. No, that was the problem. The West was the problem to begin with. So I think that this ramping up is what you're seeing as a result of what's happened in Iran, what's happened in Kursk, the growing relationship between Russia and the DPRK. I mean, the DPRK now, the Western media was talking about this. The DPRK now has emerged as a de facto recognized nuclear power on par with the major nuclear powers. It's never been treated that way. It's been treated as a rogue pariah state that had a few nuclear weapons.
Right.
Now it's taking the rostrum next to two major nuclear powers as the third nuclear power in the equation. And that's
they have treated it that way.
Yeah. The other nuclear powers, if you think about it, the other nuclear powers. So you, if you have on one side, you have the Western nuclear powers, then you have the Eastern nuclear powers. And if you look at the SCO, for example, what happened in Beijing, you have now five of them. You have the Russian Federation, you have China, you have the DPRK, and you have India and Pakistan, all of whom were participating in one way or another in these initiatives, mm-hmm. right? And so that's very important because it offsets the United States, the United Kingdom, and France, the Western nuclear powers. And so you see, there are five major nuclear powers in the East. There are three major nuclear powers in the West. So now the nuclear balance of power has shifted as well. And it's overwhelmingly on the Eurasian side of the equation. So I think that that's very important to recognize here. And all of these things have ramped up a lot of the new security architecture, which we're seeing in Beijing, in Tianjin, and elsewhere.
Yeah. And you mentioned India. And I believe that this is Putin's after SCO conference, press conference. And here he is talking about India.
Индия почти полтора миллиарда человек, Китай миллиард триста миллионов с мощными экономиками, но и со своими внутриполитическими законами. Вы понимаете, ведь когда со стороны говорят, а мы вас сейчас вот прижучим, мы вас сейчас накажем. Но как руководство таких стран, мощных, больших, которые пережили очень непростые периоды своей истории, связанные с колониализмом, связанные с попытками наезда в течение длительного исторического периода на их суверенитет. Как они должны реагировать? Но если кто-то из них даст слабину, все, политическая карьера закончилась. Так же, как закончилась колониальная эпоха. Но это невозможно сегодня. В таком тоне разговаривать с такими партнерами.
The colonial era is over. Talking about China, I think India is more important here. The colonial era is over. You can't talk to our partners like that anymore.
Of course, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the main driving. When you hear the East speak about relations, they speak about win-win economic cooperation, win-win diplomacy. They speak about this in terms of mutually beneficial relationships. The West still speaks in the language of dominance and extraction. You hear that? My way or the highway, us versus them. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. This kind of Manichaean worldview is exactly the problem that's being addressed in the East. And I think that that's what many of these leaders, including what President Putin just said, are understanding. You can't treat us like we are in the colonial period and you're coming with, you know, the British flag or the French flag or the German flag or the Spanish flag and you're going to plant it here, or the American flag in the 20th century or late 19th century. You're going to plant it here and say, this is our rules and you play by the game. I mean, that's ultimately the root of this issue at this point.
Threw up a banner for Nick. Nick, thanks for joining us. Please follow Revolutionary Blackout Network on X, one of our partners.
Shout out to RBN.
Well, we did get, of course, Trump. Who would Trump be if he didn't react to what's happening? Of course, we mentioned India. This is Trump saying, it looks like we've lost India to and Russia to deepest, darkest China. So may they have a long and prosperous future together. Salty.
Very salty.
Admitting defeat. And I think this one's the more important of the two. The big question to be answered is whether or not President Xi of China will mention the massive amount of support and blood that the United States of America gave to China in order to help secure its freedom from a very unfriendly foreign invader. Please give my May President Xi and the wonderful people of China have a great and lasting day of celebration. And there's the kicker. Please give my warmest regards to Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un as you conspire against the United States of America.
First and foremost, shout out to the Flying Tigers and the American volunteers who helped.
Yeah, right?
Who helped, you know, China. But let's be honest, it was the Chinese people who overwhelmingly fought the Japanese. The Americans, of course, did their part in the Pacific. But in terms of China, it was the Chinese people who fought to the tune of millions, tens of millions who were killed.
20
and
million.
Tens of millions more who fought in their own ways, village to village, you know, city to city to defeat. And don't forget, the U.S. at this period was also supporting Chiang Kai-shek.
Yes.
So let's not, you know, let's not. And his, of course, wife was always the favorite guest in Washington and all this stuff. Let's not forget what actually transpired in history at this point in China.
Our drug runners in Taiwan and Hong Kong and yada, yada, yada. But of course, you put Kim on the par with these as a sort of a peer with the other world powers. But that's not even that outlandish, because here's Donald Trump doing it anyway. And now we're finding out this week, funnily enough, that we tried to kill him or to at least spy on him with SEAL Team 6, of all people. Yet another notch in the on the bedpost of failed missions of SEAL Team 6 trying to overthrow leaders. But let's get a little context. In early 2019, President Trump authorized a top secret mission deploying SEAL Team 6 Red Squadron to infiltrate North Korea and plant a listening device for intercepting Kim Jong-un's communications. This plan involved a nuclear submarine deploying mini subs carrying SEALs through the frigid waters, relying on delayed satellite intel. This collapsed when they encountered a small fishing boat. And instead of, you know, I don't know, not killing them, they killed them and then weighed their bodies down and then escaped safely. This is all during the time when Trump's making his historic visit to the demilitarized zone and meeting with Kim. Can we ever, ever negotiate in good faith? Ever?
Listen, the so-called peace president, right? Oh, the peace president, this and that. We didn't even know that this happened. And this was while he was negotiating with Kim Jong-un. It's now very much apparent. It's no wonder why Kim has not rekindled that friendship or that, you know, sort of partnership with President Trump, because chances are they might not have found the bodies of the DPRK sailors, fishermen, civilians who were out there in those frigid waters doing their daily task of getting fish and whatever else from the sea for their people. But ultimately, when this information reached Pyongyang, of course, this is really a declaration of war in a way.
It is.
This is a violation of territorial sovereignty of a country. This is the killing of unarmed civilians. I mean, we should be thankful that Kim Jong-un has so much strategic patience and is so stable as a leader. He's the stable one, not the orange man in Washington. Kim Jong-un is a stable one, along with Presidents Putin and Xi. They are the ones that are not in rogue nations. They are the ones in deeply sane and, you know, strong government nations that provide for security and welfare. The United States is the rogue nation, along with Israel, going out bombing everybody right and left if they don't agree with them, if they don't like the same color. You know, it's just insane. So this news is really a bombshell. I'm surprised it's not a bigger story, because ultimately it disproves everything Trump has said about himself. And it only proves that the United States still is in the firm hands and control of the same warmongers and neocons and regime change proponents that have been on the front for the past 4 or 5 decades, since the Cold War, since before. It's the same. Nothing's changed.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing's changed at all. And I mean, if we're not going to go after Kim, we're just going to set it up so we could go after his daughter. Is this the most dangerous 12-year-old in the world? What? This one, they can't even go watch a parade. It's just, it's absolute madness. That was from the British, which, I mean, really, they're just our alt account at this point. But from one boat to the other boat where we kill civilians, Venezuela. Obviously, we're going to talk about Venezuela. This week, we had multiple flyovers of F-16s, Venezuelan F-16s purchased from the United States in the 70s, I believe. They flew over U.S. ships multiple times. Trump warned that they would maybe be shot down. And then Maduro, I'll just play him because Maduro is the best.
Venezuela es un país no relevante en materia de narcotráfico y en todas las materias que tenga que ver. Así que esta mentira es tan burda y tan falaz como que Irak tenía armas de destrucción masiva. Es mentira. Y se lo digo a la opinión pública estadounidense. Podremos tener diferencia en formas de pensar, en lo filosófico, en lo político, en lo económico. Pero por favor, no se dejen meter una mentira más para una guerra más fratricida ahora en Sudamérica y en el Caribe. Sudamérica, Latinoamérica y el Caribe quiere paz. Y ya lo acaba de decir la comunidad de estados latinoamericanos y caribeños.
Another lie for our fratricidal war like Iraq. What are your feelings about how this is kind of materializing in Venezuela? We did shoot the boat. The Colombian president said, you know, we, even if it was a drug trafficking boat, we don't kill the people. We've been arresting drug traffickers for decades. We usually don't wind up killing them. And we have no proof, no updates, no nothing that these people were trafficking drugs, which, by the way, the boat would have never made it to the United States. But regardless.
I just was in Venezuela, late July?
Yeah, July.
I was there for a major conference, had the opportunity to shake hands with President Maduro, to see Alex Saab and everyone there. The main thing is this. The Venezuelan people continue to pursue their own path of development. They continue to pursue their path of socialism in the 21st century. They follow the line of the commander Hugo Chavez. They follow in the footsteps of Simon Bolivar and all the great revolutionaries. And of course, this is a threat because, as everybody now knows from all the infographics floating around social media, Venezuela has the largest reserve of petroleum in the world at this point. So given that fact, and given the fact that it doesn't only have petroleum products, it has gold, it has timber, it has virgin agricultural land. Venezuela is basically feeding itself now without needs for imports on a lot of its agricultural goods, thanks in part to the sanctions that were imposed ruthlessly by the first Trump administration. So when you have this happening, of course, now the U.S. is trying again on trumped up charges that somehow Maduro and Diaz-Cabello and all these people are involved in drug running and they have this drug gang and it's all connected to what's going on in the U.S. Well, let me tell you one thing. If you have a drug problem, it's not the supplier that's the main issue. It's the consumers that are the main issue. And since the United States is the number one net importer of drugs, maybe that's the problem. Maybe Trump should go after his sons and daughters and all their friends and their circles who are snorting lines of coke and having good times and good parties. Maybe they should be the ones to figure out, hey, what's going on around here, right? But the main thing is this. The United States wants to justify further military aggression against another country at this point. Since it didn't have enough in terms of bombing Iranian civilian nuclear program, and since it didn't have enough supporting a genocidal war against the Palestinian people, and since it didn't have enough supplying arms to Ukraine to kill Russian civilians and Russian soldiers, not only in the Donbass and Crimea, but also in Russian Federation territory, I think that that's very important to note that the United States is on a warpath with this. And the deployment of naval assets, aerial assets, and this kind of much more aggressive language is very, very concerning. Because if Trump claims to be the president who's all about immigration, well, launching a war against a stable South American country and drawing the whole region, because it won't just stay in Venezuela. It's going to spill over into neighboring countries, including Colombia. So starting a war that could lead to this kind of escalation and really radically reshape South America and create instability, which will lead to what? Mass migration of people trying to leave a war zone. And where are they going to go? They might head up this way, right? They might head up towards the United States. So I think that that's very important to understand and to recognize. But of course, the people who are cheering this on, they don't care, because they can both justify a war and then clamp down immigration and try to win on both sides. And what do they ultimately do? They further entrench the United States in more draconian laws, more surveillance, more military industrial power. And there we go. There we have that slippage back to the darkest fantasies of Dick Cheney, Bush,
neocons,
and the rest of the neocons, including, of course, John Bolton, who was raided by the FBI. At least somebody else was raided beside myself. So that was nice.
And me.
And you, of course, you know.
Well, so. I mean, speaking of neocons, Gusano in Chief went down to Mexico.
Son grupos narcoterroristas designados por leyes de Estados Unidos, operando en aguas internacionales con destino a llevar drogas a las calles de los Estados Unidos. Y el presidente utilizó la fuerza y el poder de Estados Unidos para prevenir, para proteger a los Estados Unidos. Y explotaron un bote. Y puede pasar de nuevo. Puede estar pasando en este momento. Puede pasar mañana. Puede pasar...
It could happen again. It could be happening right now. And don't think that's not even the worst of it. The vice friggin' president. Now, I hate the Krasensteins too, but this exchange, killing cartel members who poison our fellow citizens, is the highest and best use of our military. Killing the citizens of another nation who are civilians without any due process is called a war crime, to which the vice president says, I don't give a shit what you call it. What is happening?
I mean, it's just the funny thing is the emperor has no clothes, and at least we don't have to, like, you know, we don't have to go through the whole rigmarole of listening to Samantha Powers talking about human rights and justice and blah, blah, blah. And we have a UN Security Council meeting and everybody's just drooling over the U.S. just blah, blahing. Now they openly say we don't give a damn about the war crimes and this and that. We're going to bomb whoever we want. We're going to send them all back to the Stone Age. We're back to 2001, 2003. You remember that time? We're going to turn Iraq into a glass parking lot. We're gonna nuke this. We're going to nuke that. We're going to blow these people. We're going to blow those people. That was what it was like. Drop nukes on Afghanistan. Drop nukes on Iraq. Drop nukes on Iran. We are there again. And that's why, to go back to the earlier question, that's why all these countries are coming together. And of course, Venezuela sent a letter to the SCO. They want to get involved. Mm-hmm. All these countries are looking and they're saying, uh-oh, this is a problem. Also, Russia, there's word that Russia has supplied Venezuela with arms. Russia has a military base possibly in Venezuela, that Russia has sent strategic equipment there. There's news that Iran has sent military equipment to Venezuela, right? Anti-ship missiles, right? So all of this just proves that these countries are basically getting more and more integrated to protect one another from a more belligerent United States.
I agree. And even more so, here we go.
Are you considering attacking the cartels inside of Venezuela? You attack?
What are you going to find out? You're going to find out.
Leaving us with a cliffhanger, but don't worry. Also this week in going with this theme. Department of War.
The fact that it was Velcroed. Just shows how the United States is in terminal decline. Who Velcroes? It doesn't happen in the Russian Federation, I'll tell you that much. No, that thing's Velcroed around here. Everything's in like concrete, stone, mosaic. Like it's not going to move. But Velcroed, yikes. I mean, maybe.
So we were doing no new wars.
No new wars. The peace president, the Nobel Prize in Peace. Everybody's recommending him.
Everybody.
Everybody's recommending him. Netanyahu, Aliyev. I mean, all the greatest peacemakers.
All the greats.
All the greatest peacemakers. That's where they're at.
The democratic leaders are recommended.
Come on. I mean, this is insane. This is unbelievable. But this is where we're at.
It doesn't end. Here we go.
It's going to fight to win, not to lose. We're going to go on offense, not just on defense. Maximum lethality, not tepid legality. Violent effect, not politically correct. We're going to raise up warriors, not just defenders. So this War Department, Mr. President, just like America, is back.
He wrote a poem.
Wow. Maybe he's looking to go to like some, I don't know, some poetry reading and just, you know, start, you know, his deepest, darkest, you know, soldier fantasies.
This is crazy. This is like LARP, like master LARP. It's like, what are with LARPing with like an actual military though? It's like,
no, this is insane. First and foremost, I saw that some people were saying that the military is woke no more, but the Department of War switched its name like basically just a few years after World War II.
Yeah.
So of course I'm thinking to myself, they were woke back then. I mean, if the 50s were woke, we're in a whole new territory at this point, because the anti-woke people look back on the 50s with nostalgia. And that's when they changed the name from Department of War to Department of Defense. But okay, I mean, who knows history anyway? As Gore Vidal famously said, for all of those who know, the United States is the United States of amnesia, because they don't remember anything. And that's just how it is. It's built into the culture. It's built into the system. So with that amnesia, of course, the U.S. has always been woke, and we got to go back. We got to reclaim it from its earliest revolutionary days. What? Where are we at? It's insanity. It's insanity, I'm telling you. And here we are, you know?
Where are we at?
I don't know.
Chris, we're declaring war on Chicago.
There it is. The U.S. is at war with itself again. 1860s are back. Here we are.
Everybody, get your brand new presidential Bible.
Oh, my God.
Go on, head on down to Chicago, Chirac, as they call it now. Now,
Chirac, that's right.
Baghdad is safer and nicer than Chicago now, but that's neither here nor there. Take your presidential Bible and your militia weapons and go down to Chirac to smell deportations in the morning. What?
I mean, it's, I don't even know. It's just so crazy. You really, listen, the U.S. is really becoming a failed state, and it's just nice that people are waking up to it and recognizing it for what it is. And this is what happens when you have a plutocracy, an oligarchy, a capitalist ruling class just running around and, you know, basically liquidating the country, destroying every social safety net, and then launching wars nonstop since the 1940s. Really, we've launched wars nonstop. Wars and regime change and covert operations. It hasn't ended.
But we won them.
We've been talking about this Department of War. So we won the First World War. We won the Second World War. We won everything before that and in between. And then we decided to go woke and we changed the name to Department of Defense. So we're going Department of War.
We lost everything after World War. So we were called the Department of Defense. Did you just admit that we lost?
Okay, maybe we didn't lose Grenada, and maybe we didn't lose like the. But my God, I mean, we have. And of course, he said everything before that. So was the U.S. like? Now I'm thinking. You know, I'm thinking of like Mehmet walking up to Constantinople, and it's like he wasn't flying like the Turkish banner. He was flying the American flag. You know, the Hannibal and Caesar and all these great leaders.
Yeah,
you know?
that video of the USSR soldier lifting the flag over the Reichstag. That's AI.
That's it.
It was an American flag.
That's it. You know, it just, you know, and everybody was wondering, like, why is China celebrating the victory in World War II? It's like, do you know how many people combined the Soviet Union and the Chinese lost? The Soviets and the Chinese lost over 60 million people. Over 60 million people. I cannot possibly. And by the way, I think it's important for the viewers to understand, and this has been documented, the Japanese could have cared less about the United States in August of 1945. Their biggest concern was the Soviet Union invading, because they knew that if Uncle Joe got his hands on mainland Japan, we got another couple oblasts, the Soviet Union. So that's what that was there. That was their big concern. So really their capitulation was much more a response to the Soviets than it was to the Americans. And this has been very well understood. So I think that that's, you know, it should come as no surprise that the United States has no clue about history, has no clue about geography, has no clue about international affairs. And this is why the USA is a laughingstock and nobody takes it seriously. And everybody knows that it's a great big economy because we're a bunch of consumers and everybody in the USA, a bunch of zombies. And George Carlin, once again, is proven correct for, you know, through time immemorial that this is just one, transcontinental, you know, strip mall from coast to coast. And there you are. That's what the United States is. One giant strip mall. And you have everything. You got your Bibles. You got your strippers. You've got your gun stores. You've got your drugs. And life's beautiful in the good old US of A. There you go. There it is. Freedom. Freedom fries. We're back.
The perfect bow to put on. This one's so great. I can't believe we got through everything in just under an hour and a half. But I will go through the super chats. Thank you, Mohammed. And yes, I am in love with the new show. It's who controls money creation, plain and simple. Okay, yeah. Guys, the show is amazing. Love it much. Thank you so much, Raphael. Sarah, yeah, I know. I am the best. Yes, India did drop visas. And also, they reinstated direct flights from India to China. So no visa and direct flights. It's really major for China and India to... reestablished.
And China and Russia have started to look at changing their visa regimes for each other. China has opened up for the Russian tourists without visas, and the Russia said that they will reciprocate. So we're going to look at greater integration as well in the cultural
and get a Russian passport
to people domain.
We need to get Russian passports.
That's it.
DPRK in China. Thank you, Tana. You found a great commentary partner. I think so. You're addressing me. And I wanted to read, again, thank you, Nick, for joining us. I wanted to read this because it's funny. I had my doubts on Chris being Iranian, but hearing him say, of course, so many times, all of my doubts are gone. Of course, Habibi. Of course.
Yeah, much shakira.
Thank you all so much for joining us. Also, guys, don't forget, we have a fully stocked merchandise store. No taxes, no tariffs. And there's really great stuff on there, including G. So visit www.ddgeopolitics.com. I don't know. And don't forget to follow us all on Twitter. Chris has TikTok still. We're banned from TikTok and Instagram. And I think we will see you guys next week if Chris is not traveling.
I'll be there.
We will be here with you guys next week. And I will leave you with our Only Fabs, not Only Fans, Only Fabs t-shirt. Guys, have a good rest of your Sunday. And Chris, get some sleep.